The vanquished, no war. They see through the empty jingoism of those who use the abstract words of glory, honor, and patriotism to mask the cries of the wounded, the senseless killing, war profiteering, and chest-pounding grief. They know the lies the victors often do not acknowledge, the lies covered up in stately war memorials and mythic war narratives filled with stories of courage and comradeship. They know the lies that permeate the thick, self-important memoirs by amoral statesmen who make wars but do not know war. The vanquished know the essence of war, death. They see that war is a state of almost pure sin, with its goals of hatred and destruction. They know how war fosters alienation, leads inevitably to nihilism, and is a turning away from the sanctity and preservation of life. All other narratives about war too easily fall prey to the allure and seductiveness of violence, as well as the attraction of the godlike power that comes with the license to kill with impunity. But the words of the vanquished come later, sometimes long after the war, when grown men and women unpack the suffering they endured as children, what it was like to see their mother or father killed or taken away, what it was like to lose their homes, their community, their security, and be discarded as human refuse. But by then few listen. The truth about war comes out, but usually too late, and we are assured by the war makers that these stories have no bearing on the glorious violent enterprise the nation is about to inaugurate. And lapping up the myth of war and its sense of empowerment, we often prefer not to look. We make our heroes out of clay. We laud their gallant deeds and give them uniforms with colored ribbons on their chest for acts of violence they commit or endure. They are our repositories of glory and honor, of power, self-righteousness, patriotism, and self-worship. All that we want to believe about ourselves. They are our plaster saints of war, the icons we cheer to defend us and make us and our nation great. But they are part of our civic religion, our love of power and force, our belief in our right as a chosen nation to wield this force against the weak and cruel. This is our nation's idolatry of itself. And it has corrupted our religious institutions, just as it has corrupted religious institutions in other nations, fusing the will of God with the will of the state to create a potent and deadly form of idolatry. When those who return from war find the courage and the honesty to disrupt our festivities, our love affair with ourselves, our worship of this idol, we cast them out like lepers. We condemn those who return from war for their own mutilations. We listen only when they speak from the script we hand them. If they speak of terrible wounds, visible and invisible, of lies told to make them kill, of the false civic religion and idol we worship, we fill our ears with wax. Not our boys, we say, not them, bred in our homes, endowed with goodness and decency, blessed by our God. For if it is easy for them to murder and kill, if the nation is not blessed and righteous and glorious, what does this mean about us? And so it is simpler not to see. We do not listen to the angry words that pour forth from their lips, wishing only that they would calm down, be reasonable, get some help, go away. We, the deformed, brand our returning prophets as madmen and cast them into the desert. Wars come wrapped in religious and patriotic slogans, calls for sacrifice, honor, promises of glory. They come wrapped in the claims of divine providence. It is what a grateful nation asks of its children. It is what is right and just. War is waged to make the nation and the world a better place, to cleanse evil. And war is touted as the ultimate test of manhood, where young men can find out what they are made of. War from a distance seems noble. It gives us a feeling of belonging, of comradeship, of power, of a chance to play a small bit in the great drama of human history. It promises to give us an identity as a warrior, a patriot, a believer, as long as we go along with a myth, the one the war makers need to wage war. But up close, war is a soulless void. The world of war descends to barbarity, perversion, pain, and an unchecked orgy of death. It is a state where human decency and tenderness is crushed, where those who make war work overtime to reduce all love and sensitivity to smut and filth. In war, the moral order is turned upside down. All that is repulsive and feared in peacetime is lauded and cheered in war. The noise, the stench, the fear, the cries of pain, the eviscerated bodies, the bloated, stinking corpses spin us into another universe. And in this moral void, often blessed by the church or the mosque or the synagogue, the hypocrisy of our social conventions, our strict adherence to religious edicts and virtues, and utter refusal to honor others comes unglued. War, for all its horror, has the power to strip away the trivia and the banal, the empty chatter and foolish, self-righteous obsessions that fill our days. It lets us see. The Reverend William Mahady, a Catholic chaplain in Vietnam, tells of a soldier, a former altar boy, in his book Out of the Night, The Spiritual Journey of Vietnam Vets, who says to him, "Hey, chaplain, how come it's a sin to hop into a bed with a mama-san, but it's okay to blow away gooks in the bush?" Consider the question that he and I were forced to confront on that day in a jungle clearing, Mahady writes. How is it that a Christian can, with a clear conscience, spend a year in a war zone killing people, and yet place his soul in jeopardy by spending a few minutes with a prostitute? If the New Testament prohibitions of sexual misconduct are to be stringently interpreted, why then are Jesus's injunctions against violence not binding in the same way? In other words, what does the commandment, "Thou shalt not kill," really mean? What does the commandment, "Thou shalt not kill," "Thou shalt not kill," really mean? What does the commandment, "Thou shalt not kill," really mean? The failure of religious institutions, whose texts are unequivocal about murder, to address the sinful state of war has left them unable to cope with the reality of war. These institutions have little or nothing to say in wartime because the god they worship is often a false god, one that promises victory and blesses violence. We all have the capacity to commit evil. It takes little to unleash it. For those of us who have been to war, this is the knowledge that is hardest for us to digest. The knowledge that the line between the victims and the victimizers is razor thin, that human beings often find a perverse delight in destruction and death, and few can resist the pull. Marines and soldiers who fight in Iraq did not plan or organize this war. They do not seek to justify it or explain its causes. They were taught in school, in worship, at home, to meld the rhetoric of the state with the rhetoric of their religion. They were taught to believe. The symbols of the nation and their faith were interwoven. The will of God became the will of the nation. But this trust, this belief, is shattered in war, and those who face combat see the myth used to send them to war implode. They see into war's essence, which which is death. War is always about betrayal. Betrayal of the young by the old, of idealists by cynics, of soldiers by politicians. The institutions, including religious institutions who mold us into compliant citizens, can often never be trusted again after war. The occupying troops in Iraq live in what the psychiatrist Robert J. Lifton calls atrocity-producing situations. In this environment where troops are surrounded by a hostile population, simple acts such as going to a store to buy a carton of Coke means you can be killed. The fear and stress leaves troops viewing everyone around them as the enemy. And when the enemy is elusive, shadowy, and hard to find, they begin to project blame for the attacks against them on all Iraqis. The rage soldiers feel after a roadside bomb explodes, killing their comrades, is one that is easily directed, Lifton argues, to innocent civilians who may, in fact, not support the insurgents. But it is a short psychological leap and a massive moral leap. It is a leap from killing to murder. And in wars such as Vietnam, Iraq, or the Israeli occupation of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, murder soon begins to dominate the conflict. A hostile environment means that the occupying forces swiftly become socialized to commit atrocities. These killing projects are never described as such at home. They are put in terms of the necessity of improving the world, of political and spiritual renewal. You cannot kill large numbers of people without a claim to virtue. Our own campaign to rid the world of terror is expressed this way, as if once we destroy all so-called terrorists, we destroy evil. But the reality on the ground is undeniable, as any soldier or marine who has watched his unit fire on an Iraqi car too close to a checkpoint and then peered into the back seat to see the gruesome remains of a murdered family knows. War, especially modern industrial warfare, sees the razing of villages, the aerial bombing of towns, the deadly toll long after the war is ended, of landmines strewn about the countryside, and the spread of disease, poverty, and birth defects caused by the poisons and destruction left behind. Murder is always an intimate part of war. But in an insurgency such as Iraq, murder outstrips killing. The local population is viewed as a base of support for armed insurgents and soon targeted. And the emotional cost is corrosive and debilitating. All this unleashes a crisis of faith. The God these soldiers and Marines knew or thought they knew fails them. They go to war unprepared for the capacity we all have for atrocity, for evil that is carried out in the name of God, freedom, and democracy. And many combat veterans are burdened by this betrayal. This is why they return and often turn their backs on organized religion, not because they have become godless, but because they have been misled by religious leaders, leaders who choose, perhaps because of their own naivete, not to teach them about the capacity we have for evil, but the hollowness of a religious creed that worships the nation and the self. War exposes the existence of original sin, of the sin of the world. Sin of the world.